From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. On the campaign trail, candidate Donald Trump vowed to scrap the Iran nuclear deal. On Friday, President Trump took a step and threw the job to Congress. But it's a step that could lead to the deal's unraveling. Trump says, so be it. Allies and critics say don't go there, that it could mean war and nukes. This hour, On Point, the Iran nuclear deal, and what now? You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. What path looks right to you? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Here was the president on Friday announcing his decision to decertify Iran's compliance with the nuclear deal.
We will not continue down a path whose predictable conclusion is more violence, more terror, and the very real threat of Iran's nuclear breakout.
And the president continued to talk about just scrapping the deal. Here he was.
In the event we are not able to reach a solution working with Congress and our allies, then the agreement will be terminated. It is under continuous review, and our participation can be canceled by me as president at any time.
We'll look at that. Of course, yes, there has been criticism and critics from all sides here. Lots of contention within the administration and certainly Democrats not happy on Friday. Here was Minnesota Democrat Senator Al Franken telling MSNBC last night that the U.S. pulling out of the Iran nuclear deal would undercut U.S. leadership and credibility going forward.
Our European allies, Russia, China, are not going to pull out. So it'll just leave us isolated. It undercuts our leadership in the world. And boy, with North Korea, this doesn't help. What kind of message does that send? That we abrogate every treaty that we sign, whether it's Paris or this, or every agreement? This just undermines our nation as a leader.
We've got big voices on this agreement in this hour. We'll hear from Trita Parsi, who advised on the deal, from Robin Wright, big longtime journalist in the region. Joining me first today from Washington is Mark Dubowitz, the CEO of the Foundation for Defense of Democracies. He never liked the Iran deal, pushed for President Trump to decertify. You can find his USA Today op-ed piece headlined Decertify, Pressure, and Fix. Link to it at our website, onpointradio.org. Mark Dubowitz, thanks for joining us today.
Hi, Tom.
You never liked this deal. What did you think of the president's step on Friday?
Well, I thought it was an important first step to make it very clear that the United States is not prepared to live with a deal that gives Iran patient pathways to nuclear weapons and intercontinental ballistic missiles. It was clear back in July that President Trump was going to decertify. So I didn't push for decertification. What I pushed for was a strategy of decertify, pressure, and fix with an attempt to try and strengthen the deal to eliminate these patient pathways to nukes and missiles to deliver them.
You've called this a major pivot point in American strategy on Iran. How so?
Well, because by decertifying, the president has ended the paralysis of Barack Obama's Iran policy. It was a paralysis where the Iranians would continue to threaten to walk away from the deal, and in doing so would paralyze the ability of the Obama administration to push back against Iran's destructive behavior. So the headline of President Trump's speech was that the United States is not prepared to be blackmailed, and that if, in fact, President Trump looks like he's prepared to walk away from the deal. And in doing so, I think he's opened up some space to actually roll out a policy that will stop Iran and their destructive activities in Syria and Iraq and around the region.
What would happen in that space? And do you think Congress is up to it? The people are talking about fixes. You've written about that. What do you mean when you say fixes?
Well, what I mean by fixes is strengthening the deal to make permanent the expiring restrictions on Iran's nuclear and missile programs, getting guaranteed access to Iran's military sites, which is where the regime has conducted secret weapons and enrichment work in the past. And Tom, as you know, Iran's leaders have repeatedly thundered that the UN weapons inspectors will never get into their military sites, which obviously is going to severely undermine the ability to verify and inspect the deal.
But they have let them in to every place that was agreed on in the deal, and the IAEA, the inspectors, say they're complying, and the American observers say they're complying, and the Europeans say they're complying.
Well, first of all, the decertification was not based on compliance. The president refused to certify not on the basis of compliance, but on the basis that too much was given to the Iranian regime for too little. And that's actually a condition for decertification in this act called the Iran Nuclear Agreement Review Act, which was passed 98-1 in the Senate and 425 in the House. I would also say that Director General Amano of the IAEA has recently said that he actually can't verify an important section of the agreement called Section T, which is required in order to confirm that Iran is not designing and developing nuclear explosive devices. I think everybody would agree that's a pretty serious inability to verify and inspect if we don't know that Iran is not designing and developing nuclear explosive devices.
Do you think the president was right to kick this to Congress? Are they up to the fixes that you envision, imagine?
Well, I think in some respects, I mean, the Congress in 2015, 61% of the U.S. Congress, Republicans and Democrats, were on record against this deal. So I think it's now time for Congress to put some teeth to that widespread bipartisan opposition to the deal. And let's see what Congress does. I think it's as important, if not more important, that the president work closely with our allies in Europe and develop a transatlantic consensus on elements of the deal that need to be fixed and how they should be fixed. And I think in his speech, he made it very clear that he intends to do both.
Do you see readiness, though, in their quarters to get involved in that? I mean, they've been quite critical, leaders of Britain and Germany over the weekend, and more Europeans saying, wait a minute here.
Well, I do, actually. I mean, I've seen French President Emmanuel Macron on three occasions. He's come out very publicly and said that France is prepared to look at ways to strengthen the deal, supplement and complement the deal. He referred to post-2025 scenarios, which means sunset provisions. He referred to Iran's ballistic missile program, which is obviously a key element of a deliverable nuclear weapon. And he talked about how to stop Iran's destructive regional activity. So he's come out on three occasions. And I think he, and I think other Europeans as well, have moved from a posture of keep it while others are saying nix it to a posture of fix it while some are saying nix it. And I think fix it is the right place to be. We need to work at ways to strengthen the deal, to complement it, to supplement it in ways that don't give Iran the ability to take patient pathways to nuclear weapons and ICBMs. That's a North Korean glide path that we obviously want to prevent now.
The president saying on Friday that he could still pull the plug on this thing. Can he? And do you recommend, you've said he shouldn't. So does he really have the leverage?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, he can. He can do that in one day by canceling President Obama's executive order that suspended and lifted the sanctions relating to the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. So he can do it. As I've said, I wouldn't recommend he does it. I recommend that he works very closely with Congress and with our European allies to try and strengthen the deal. But he has to have all options on the table. So if the deal cannot be strengthened, cannot be fixed, and we're in a situation where Iran, by merely complying with the deal, can end up with pathways to nuclear weapons and ICBMs, then he retains the right as President of the United States to walk away.
Mark Dubowitz, please stand by there in Washington. With us now from Washington as well, Robin Wright, contributing writer for The New Yorker. She's a fellow at the Wilson Center, the U.S. Institute of Peace, longtime correspondent for The Washington Post, CBS News, L.A. Times. Deep roots in this region and in this issue. Robin Wright, welcome back to On Point.
Hi, Tom.
What do you see unfolding here with the president's speech on Friday?
Well, it is a nix or fix option. And the problem is there is no middle ground. And there are deep, deep fundamental differences between the United States and all the other parties to the negotiations. The six major powers of the world did the deal with Iran. And all of them are committed to maintaining the deal. The British Foreign Secretary called his Iranian counterpart on Saturday and reaffirmed Britain's commitment, the commitment of our closest ally. The head of the European Union had said, pointed out that no one country can kill the deal or force a new set of negotiations, that this was not only agreed to by all the major powers, but became a Security Council resolution passed unanimously. There are so many differences in not just in the approach of the Trump and Obama administrations, but in looking at how this plays out down the road. For the first time in 40 years since the 1979 revolution, the United States and its European allies are split on how to deal with Iran, and that weakens, in the end, the U.S. position.
Where exactly is the split, Robin? Are Europeans saying, don't touch the deal? Mark's suggesting that they're prepared to also get in there and fix it.
There is a commitment among the Europeans to try to deal with the other issues, human rights abuses, support for terrorism, the missile tests, a host of issues the United States has with Iran. The Obama administration believed that if you took the most dangerous issue off the table, that it was then possible to open up negotiations on other issues, that we'd end this longstanding hostility, take that the dangerous weapon off the table at a time that Iran was getting a nuclear capability. The Trump administration believes you have to take a comprehensive approach and deal with all the issues all at the same time. And the United States, I think, is now quite vulnerable to being unable to fix any of them, because it's not going to come up with – I think there'll be friction on the Hill over what to do, whether it's to introduce new legislation or to reimpose sanctions. And I think that'll kind of lead, that could lead us to a kind of policy purgatory in Washington. And I think there's going to be real difficulty then with our allies that undermine our credibility, as Senator Franken pointed out, when at a time we really need some kind of unity to deal on the North Korean crisis, which is much more serious and looming. It undermines our credibility on all international treaties with our allies, and makes it difficult to deal with, whether it's the crisis in the Ukraine, environmental control, just a host of issues. So the problem is, it doesn't seem that there is a tangible alternative that is acceptable to both Democrats and Republicans, or even acceptable to all the parties who signed on to this deal.
Is this just noise, Robin, or could the deal come apart under this new pressure from the Trump White House?
I don't think the deal is going to come apart. The question is whether the United States will ultimately end up walking away, as the president threatened to terminate it.
Support for this podcast and the following message comes from ZipRecruiter, who understands when you run a business, you've got important decisions to make every day, like hiring. ZipRecruiter makes finding quality candidates simple. With one click at ZipRecruiter.com/OP, you can post your job to 100 leading job sites across the web and manage your candidates all in one place with ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use dashboard. Find out today why ZipRecruiter has been used by businesses of all sizes to hire. Try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/OP.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we are talking about what happens now with Iran and the Iran nuclear deal after Donald Trump's pronouncement on Tehran last Friday. You can join the conversation this hour. What do you see happening here? What is President Trump doing? Is it wise? Is it in the country's best interest? Are other countries going to trust that the United States keeps its word after the Iran deal, the Paris Agreement, NAFTA, TPP? Do we have enough to worry about right now with a nuclear North Korea? Or is this all part of that picture in your mind? Trump people out on the circuit over the weekend talking about this. National Security Advisor H.R. McMaster telling Fox News on Sunday that the president's threat to cancel or blow up the Iran nuclear deal has laid out a marker for U.S. allies and Iran to fix what he called a weak deal.
What the president, though, has done is he has set out a marker to the Iranians and to our allies and partners, that we have to fix fundamental flaws in this deal. It's a weak deal that is being weakly monitored. And so the president has made clear that he will not permit this deal to provide cover for what we know is a horrible regime to develop a nuclear weapon.
Minority Leader Democrat Nancy Pelosi said this takes us in the wrong direction, ignores the consensus of nuclear experts and the president's own people.
The president is ignoring the overwhelming consensus of nuclear scientists, national security experts, generals, and his own cabinet, including, reportedly, the Secretary of Defense and the Secretary of State.
And Iran's Foreign Minister, Mohammad Javad Zarif, who negotiated the nuclear agreement on behalf of his country, told CBS News on Saturday, President Trump's move to decertify undermines U.S. credibility internationally.
Nobody else would trust any U.S. administration to engage in any long-term negotiation, because the length of any commitment, the duration of any commitment from now on with any U.S. administration would be the reminder of the term of that president.
Mark Dubowitz is with us, CEO of the Foundation for Defense of Democracies. He was flat out against the deal to begin with, looking for a fix now, says maybe we can get it. Robin Wright is here, contributing writer for The New Yorker. You can link to her terrific piece, Trump Defies the World on Iran, at our website, onpointradio.org. With us as well from Washington right now, Trita Parsi advised the Obama administration on the deal in the first place, author of Losing an Enemy, Obama, Iran, and the Triumph of Diplomacy, though that's all in question right now. He's founder and president of the National Iranian American Council. Trita Parsi in Washington, thank you for joining us. What do you make of the president's step on Friday?
Thank you so much. Well, I think this is not so much an issue about fixing or nixing the deal. This is much more about nixing the deal. As Federica Mogherini said, who leads the EU on foreign policy, there's nothing to fix because the deal is actually working. It is delivering. It has prevented Iran's paths to a nuclear weapon. And the IAEA has now 8 times certified not only that the Iranians are living up to the deal, but also that we have the most robust, the world's most robust inspections regime that ever has been created. I think what I'm starting to see is actually something that is starting to look increasingly like the Iraq scenario. We have Secretary Tillerson saying on TV that the real end game is regime change. If you take that position, then you can really see that everything we're seeing right now is just a pretense of diplomacy while we're actually pursuing regime change, which, just like in Iraq, very likely will lead to a military confrontation with Iran. If this was truly about the potential flaws of the deal, I think we would have seen a much different position from the Europeans, who are just as concerned about nonproliferation as the US is. Instead, all we're seeing is that the only countries that have come out in support of President Trump's position is Saudi Arabia, UAE, and Israel. 3 countries that not only oppose the deal, but actually were on record pursuing and pushing the United States to take military action against Iran.
So what's the net effect, Trita, to your mind, of President Trump pushing in this direction? This is what he talked about on the campaign trail, said worst agreement in the history of the United States, said he would scrap it. Now he's pushing that way, but not actually doing it. What's the net effect, Trita?
No, I think he is doing it. I think there was an expectation that he would do it in one single move. Instead, he's doing it in 2 or perhaps 3 moves. What he said, and you played it in the beginning of the show, he essentially said that he wants to make changes to the deal. First of all, the United States, nor the U.S. Congress or any other country, is in a position to unilaterally change the terms of the deal. We know how we would react if the Iranians were so reckless to suggest that they're just going to unilaterally change the terms of the deal. But the changes in specific, particularly that he's looking for, are changes that will ensure that the Iranians will not say yes. So it will lead to a scenario in which the deal collapses. And then he also said, as you played the tape, that if Congress doesn't do this, then he himself will terminate the deal. So every path that he's actually presenting would lead to the deal getting collapsed or getting killed. The only way to avoid that is actually not to go down the path that Trump is proposing.
Robin Wright, do you see this as pushing us toward a path of open conflict with Iran? Or is there some room here for the kind of fixes that Mark Dubowitz is hopeful for?
Well, I just don't see the Hill agreeing on fixes. And I also don't see our European and other signatories to the deal agreeing to fixes either. So this is where we move into this kind of no man's land. And the danger is that we get into a kind of a slippery slope, as we did in Iraq. I don't see open conflict with Iran. But I think the big question is the administration looking for regime change? In other words, to a kind of counter-revolution. And I think 40 years after the uprising that ousted the monarchy, that seems unlikely. Now, there are huge divisions within Iran. The majority of the people in Iran have been born since the revolution. The majority of the electorate has been born since the revolution. And they are the ones putting in power people like President Rouhani, who campaigned on ending tensions with the West, solving the nuclear standoff, and negotiations that included the United States. Of course, he faces significant opposition from hardliners in Iran, the Revolutionary Guards, and other factors. And the big question is, has this rallied support for the revolution, for the theocracy? And that's, of course, something that's the U.S. has, Democrats or Republicans, has tried to prevent. They wanted to kind of foster those divisions, and they hope that the younger generation would begin to change, moderate, and normalize a revolutionary regime. And one of the things the foreign minister tweeted on over the weekend was that all Iranians now stand behind the Revolutionary Guards, which as part of President Trump's announcement were sanctioned by the Treasury Department.
Designated as a terrorist organization.
Well, not quite, but they were sanctioned. And and so this is this further complicates it and plays into the political dynamics of Iran. And again, because it's not fully clear whether the administration really wants to see the supreme leader ousted, the democratically elected president, even though it's a skewed democracy for sure, tightly controlled democratic vote, but whether they want to see that ousted and someone else put in. This is where we're kind of in a no man's land in terms of what are the alternatives and what are the ultimate policy goals. And I'm not convinced that it stops just with fixing the nuclear deal.
Fixing, if that's if people can agree on what that would mean, looks daunting in itself. Mark Dubowitz, if there are potential fixes out there, how would you describe the ones of greatest interest and what are the odds of them actually happening?
Well, Tom, as I described, it's the sunset provisions. It's the fact that the Iranians are denying access to military sites. They fund about that every day. Their long-range ballistic missiles, their ICBM program. But it's important, Tom, to put this in historical precedent. We all think this is some unique moment in American history. There is ample precedent to amend the Iran nuclear. Congress has required amendments to more than 200 treaties before receiving Senate consent, including significant bilateral Cold War arms control agreements with the Soviets that dealt with test bans and nuclear explosions, multilateral agreements like the Chemical Weapons Convention, which was negotiated with 87 participating countries, including Iran, by President Clinton. SALT I was canceled. SALT II was let to die in the Senate. The Bush administration walked away from the ABM treaty with respect to ballistic missiles. And actually, President Obama himself canceled an agreement that President Bush negotiated with Poland and Czechoslovakia Czech Republic to provide missile defense. He actually canceled that agreement, and he actually canceled it on the 70th anniversary of the Russian invasion of Poland, which, as you can imagine, the Poles were not too happy about. So this whole notion that we can't amend deals is just not historical. And in fact, we negotiated with the Soviets when they had thousands of nuclear tipped missiles aimed at our cities. And we changed deals. We walked away from deals. And this deal is not even a treaty.
It's not an old deal. It's still pretty fresh. And it was, you know, it was very, very tightly and meticulously negotiated over a long time. But you're saying, never mind. Is that all right for the U.S. reputation, Mark, when it comes to international affairs?
Well, what's wrong for the U.S. reputation is actually stick to agreements that are not in the vital national security interests of the United States. And they provide Iran patient pathways to nuclear weapons and ICBMs. The fact of the matter, this was not a treaty. It was not submitted to the U.S. Senate for ratification. It's a joint comprehensive plan of action, which requires a new plan of action. And when the administration refuses to submit what they call the landmark nuclear deal to the Senate for ratification, then they should really appreciate that at some point in the future, another U.S. Congress or another president is going to look for amendments and fixes to that deal. As I said, that's happened 200 times in U.S. history. So this is not a unique moment in the annals of U.S. arms control or nonproliferation history.
Be specific, if you would, about a couple of points. You say get move away from patient pathways, but a couple of specific fixes you'd like to see. I'd like to weigh whether our panel thinks Tehran could conceivably go there.
Well, as I said earlier, they need to make permanent these expiring restrictions on Iran's nuclear and missile programs, right? These restrictions actually go away over time, and they start to go away in about 4 or 5 years with respect to conventional arms and then missiles and then advanced centrifuge deployment. Within 8 years from now, Iran can install thousands of advanced centrifuges in its enrichment facilities. Within 13 years, it is basically home free. And people say that Iran will still be bound by the Non-Proliferation Treaty, which bars Iran from having a nuclear weapon. If that was the case, if the NPT was a good enough bar, why do we negotiate a nuclear agreement with Iran? The fact of the matter is this regime could never be trusted. It engaged in decades of nuclear mendacity. It developed clandestine military nuclear programs. And that's why we need permanent restrictions on its program, not temporary restrictions that go away over time.
Trita, can you imagine Tehran agreeing to that?
Of course not. And I think Mark knows very well that the Iranians would never agree to anything like that. And that's why I think some people are pushing for these things, because they want to kill the deals, so they're pushing for measures that will ensure that there will not be an agreement. Let me just give you an example. In November 2000, 13, as I describe in my book, the Obama administration had secretly negotiated with the Iranians in Oman and actually managed to get essentially an interim deal that was 95% ready. The Europeans were not aware of this, and they were actually quite upset when they found out that there had been a secret negotiation that they were not involved with. No one was as upset as the French. And when they walked into the negotiations, they came in with the intent of making sure that they sabotage it, just to make clear that they were not happy about what happened. And the one thing that they focused on was to go and strike out three words that said that at the end of this deal, Iran would be a normal non-proliferation treaty member, meaning no permanent punishments, no permanent restrictions beyond what already is in the NPT. And quite predictably, the Iranians walked out. It took 10 days to get over that issue. And by the time it was fixed because the language the French had struck was put back in. So we have a clear precedent of knowing very well that this is something that will kill the deal rather than fixing the deal. But let me say something else. If there have been examples in which the United States has been able to walk away from a treaty for whatever reasons, the ability to be able to get a better deal is dependent upon the United States having the credibility of actually being understood as a party that wants to fix it. That is not a credibility that the Trump administration currently has. On the contrary, from the very beginning, he has been spreading falsehoods about this deal. No one in the European Union believes that Trump is actually interested in getting a better deal. And if Trump actually was, there is a very easy and clear path for him to do so. You ask for an additional negotiation, not something that nixes the current deal, but something that you add on. But in order to be able to do that, you need to first respect the existing deal. Trump's behavior gives absolutely no confidence that he's actually trying to fix anything. It only gives confidence that he's trying to kill this deal.
Let me get to AJ on. We got a lot of callers here. Austin, Texas. AJ, thank you for calling. What do you think? You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Great show as always. My point is that, it seems to be that President Trump, his guiding principle is undoing anything that President Obama has done. And the timing of this is terrible because his little rocket man is watching closely. What trust can North Korea have on anything negotiated to denuclearize that situation when really the push to nix this thing should be really focused on fixing Iran? It's not a perfect deal, but I'm subscriber of keeping your friends close and your enemies even closer. And the timing of this whole activity is just completely, completely off by this president.
AJ, we've got it. Robin Wright, what about North Korea watching this? AJ thinks that, Rex Tillerson says he's trying until the first bomb drops. Odd language, but to negotiate something there. What about the effect of all this on North Korea watching on and its nuclear program?
Yes, in many ways, the real dangers to the president's position play out on the international stage, unrelated to the Iranian nuclear deal. North Korea at the top of the list. I've been to North Korea. I went with Madeleine Albright on the only trip by a senior U.S. official since the war ended in 1953. And it's quite clear that the North Koreans will be watching every word and every action taken on Iran. It will indicate whether a deal is possible and the danger that any deal that one president signs on to, the next president can simply walk away from. It affects not just the Obama-Trump dynamics. It also affects the Trump and whoever succeeds him dynamic. So and we are really in an escalatory pathway, given the rhetoric and given the tests that the North Koreans have engaged in over the last few months. We are really at a danger point. And I worry a great deal that these two issues, Iran and North Korea, which we managed to separate, are now terribly interlinked and will have a huge impact. I worry more about a war with North Korea than I do with a war with Iran. But the war with North Korea, in part because the North Koreans don't see any way out of this.
Is that why Secretary of Defense Mattis reportedly wanted to keep this cool on the Iran front because he's looking at such a hot zone in Northeast Asia, North Korea?
There's no question that there was a huge internal debate spanning 9 months over Iran policy generally and specifically over the nuclear deal. And we know that there were certain voices, particularly within the military, who were opposed to walking away from the deal.
But we've also heard that there are the voices in the U.S. military that want a show of force against Iran. We'll look at that. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about what happens now with Iran and the Iran nuclear deal. After Donald Trump's pronouncement on Tehran and the deal last Friday, Robin Wright is with us, contributing writer for The New Yorker, longtime big reporter on this region. She's gone deep. Her books, Rock the Kasbah, Dreams and Shadows. Trita Parsi is with us, advised the Obama administration on the Iran nuclear deal, founder, president of the National Iranian American Council, and author of the book that takes you through all the back story of how this deal came laboriously together, losing an enemy, Obama, Iran, and the triumph of diplomacy. Mark Dubowitz is here, expert on Iran, wanted to see the White House decertify, certainly fix, as he sees it, the Iran deal. He's CEO and Foundation for the Defense of Democracies. You can join us. Do you see a better deal out there? Do you see chaos? Do you see war? Here was the president on Friday, said that Iran had violated the spirit of the accord.
The Iran deal was supposed to contribute to regional and international peace and security. And yet, while the United States adheres to our commitment under the deal, the Iranian regime continues to fuel conflict, terror, and turmoil throughout the Middle East and beyond. Importantly, Iran is not living up to the spirit of the deal.
American allies in this deal, kind of very high eyebrows this weekend. Think, wait a minute, what's going on here? But not everybody. We had yesterday on CBS's Face the Nation, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu praising the president for what he called a brave decision on the Iran nuclear deal.
And I think the president was very courageous in saying, I'm not going to kick this can down the road. I'm not going to say, well, it's going to be on somebody else's watch. I'm going to stop this from happening.
But was Iran complying? The chairman of the U.S. Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Joseph Dunford, on October 3rd, told the Senate Armed Services Committee, yes, Iran was complying with the nuclear deal.
Iran is not in material breach of the agreement, and I do believe the agreement to date has delayed the development of a nuclear capability by Iran.
Of course, the president's talking the spirit, not exactly material breach here. John in Portland, Maine, thank you for calling, John. You're on.
The people that voted this clown into office should be ashamed of themselves. The only person on your panel that is akin to them is Mark. Everybody else that I've heard from and about agrees that this is just another typical Trump maneuver that is labeled as something other than stupid.
John, okay, we got it. You're not happy with the way this is going. Mark Dubowitz, you're sticking with it. There's a lot of skepticism, and you've heard it right on the air here, about whether Tehran will actually ever come around to a fix on this or whether we end up in some kind of, you know, sword-tip-to-sword-tip situation, Mark.
Look, the worst way we can negotiate with Iran or with anyone is to basically say up front that they're not going to accept certain conditions and therefore preemptively fold our cards.
But we already negotiated this deal with them.
Well, that's all the more reason why we need to negotiate a follow-on agreement and supplemental agreements, as Emmanuel Macron, the French president, has said. Agreements that even he says and fixes that he says need to be addressed. For example, what happens in 2025. I mean, Tom, it makes no sense to conclude agreement and leave it as such, where the restrictions on Iran's nuclear program go away over time. Iran can emerge with an industrial size enrichment capability with, as President Obama said, near zero nuclear breakout, advanced centrifuges, which give it the ability to have an easier clandestine sneak out, and intercontinental ballistic missiles, a $1 trillion economy immunized against our ability to use sanctions in the future, and regional hegemony and destructive behavior. That's the lethal Iranian end state that's happening in a decade. So why would we stick with a deal as is that's going to reach a lethal Iranian end state? Why not try to actually fix the deal? We first have to work with Congress on a bipartisan basis. We have to work with our Europeans. And at some point, when it's appropriate, if the Iranians are willing to sit down and negotiate a follow-on agreement, then we should be prepared to do that at some point in the future. Now, we should do that when we have more leverage. And I think that's the whole goal of the Iran policy that was rolled out, is to use all instruments of national power against Iran and actually build the leverage for a future negotiation.
Robin, if I may, Robin, what do you make of that depiction of what has been happening here?
Well, first of all, the president did talk about Iran being in violation of the spirit of the accord, even though we know that every party agrees that Iran is complying, including the administration, that Iran is not engaged in any technical violations at all. And the word spirit comes from one sentence in the preface of the 159-page accord, mm-hmm. that talks about that there is anticipated or a hope that this agreement will lead to other cooperation on regional and international issues. And it's the kind of language that is in many international treaties. And that's the one that the administration has honed in justifying its decision. Now, we're in talking about how you fix the deal. One of the questions is, and one of the proposals mm-hmm. is, that they deal with issues that are not part of the deal, that are related to whether it's human rights abuses or support for terrorism or missile tests. And those are issues that perhaps could be dealt with in some kind of sequential follow-up agreement. Okay, we've got this one deal. It's worked. Let's try to deal with others and come up with agreement on whether it's ending Syria's civil war or security in the very volatile Persian Gulf, where there is not just one conflict but many. And that's that seems to be more logical and more viable.
But is there leverage here, Robin, to do that? Can you threaten, as the president now has, to scrap as far as he can the entire deal, maybe try and bring sanctions back and hope to get Iran into a conversation about all of these issues? Is it sufficient leverage to do that?
Oh, absolutely not. I mean, if we terminate or we try to change the parameters of the deal unilaterally, it's clear that Iran would not be interested in talking about anything else. And so by walking away from the accord, we actually could make more vulnerable agreement on other issues. And I think that's the kind of long-term danger. Just let me point out one thing everyone is concerned about the sunset clauses, the fact that there are specific dates, whether it's 10, 15, 20, or 25 years.
Staggered, yeah.
For various aspects of its weaponry program. But there are also three places in the accord where it says that Iran can never get a nuclear weapon. And so you have this kind of rhetorical debate going on about, well, is it going to begin doing, resuming activity that would lead to a nuclear program the day after the expiration of 5, 10, 15, or 10 through 25 years. Mm-hmm. And it's not clear that never trust the Iranians. This is a revolutionary regime that's deeply opposed, used deeply offensive language about the United States and Israel and other parties in the region. And one should never trust them. But there are that doesn't necessarily mean they're automatically going to resume a nuclear weapons program down the road. That would be violation of the accord. And the irony is, by walking away, we're the first ones that look like we're violating the accord.
Tom, can I chime in here as well?
Yes, please, Trita.
So, again, I think we're seeing a similarity with how the Iraq war unfolded here, because we have this list of complaints about everything Iran is doing, much of it quite legitimate, combined with a statement by Tillerson that the ultimate objective, the real end game, is regime change. And then we're not presenting actually a solution how to address many of these different issues. So, for instance, if we want to have stronger terms when it comes to restrictions on their program, etc., well, the way to achieve that is to put something on the table. What are you willing to give to get the Iranians to agree to something that perhaps is more attractive than what is already in the deal? By never saying what we're willing to put on the table, but only listing everything that we would like to see the Iranians give up, we're actually making it clear we're not talking about a negotiation. We're talking about the Iranians essentially capitulating, which they won't, and as a result, we will end up having a collapsed deal. And once the deal collapses, the two very negative scenarios that were taken off the table through this deal, one, the Iranians being able to get access to a nuclear bomb, and two, the U.S. ending up in a war with Iran, these were taken off the table. They will come back onto the table once this deal collapses. And one last point. Mark keeps on mentioning that after the deal, the Iranians will essentially be able to have a nuclear weapon, as Bibi Netanyahu said that this deal paves their way to a nuclear bomb. Well, in year 8 of this deal, the Iranians are supposed to ratify the additional protocol. Right now, they're implementing it, but in year 8, once the U.S. Congress actually lifts sanctions, the Iranians will ratify it, which then will make it permanently part of their law. No country has built a nuclear weapon while ratifying the additional protocol, because it gives the IAEA such intrusive inspections that it is essentially impossible for them to get a nuclear bomb. However, by nixing the deal while pretending to fix it, we are now jeopardizing the opportunity to get the Iranians to ratify the additional protocol and give us the best possible guarantee that they will not get a nuclear weapon.
Mark in North Kingston, Rhode Island. Mark, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom. I have a comment and a question. Mm-hmm. First, my comment is from a standpoint of negotiation, I don't think it's a question of credibility. I think it is entirely a question of leverage, and that's ultimately what's going to give us the ability, if we ever have it, to negotiate effectively with any regime.
Okay.
And then in regard to a question, you know, to me, it seems that if we have the ability, the IAEA has the ability to inspect only certain facilities, and an engineer with the knowledge and materials and equipment could make a centrifuge at a military facility, how can we possibly be confident that they're not still currently engaged in the activity of developing a nuclear weapon?
Mark, let us pick it up right here. Robin Wright, Mark Dubowitz has expressed that doubt about military facilities. What about that carve-out in the deal and our caller's question?
Well, it's a legitimate question, but the head of the IAEA, the International Atomic Energy Agency, which is the UN nuclear watchdog, has said that they have been able to visit every site they wanted to. There is also a joint commission where, if we believe that there are questions about military sites, we can go and ask for more pervasive or extensive inspections. So that so far has not been an issue. It's a hypothetical, but we're not there yet. And clearly, the military sites is a sensitive one, and it's what ultimately led us to war with Iraq when Saddam Hussein refused to allow inspections of military or sensitive government installations. So you can see why it's an issue. The question is it an issue with Iran right now?
Can I jump in here, please?
Mark, yeah, sure.
I appreciate that. Thank you. I think it's very important. I think the caller is exactly right. I mean, the Iranians, the Supreme Leader, President Rouhani, Foreign Minister Zarif, the head of Iran's nuclear program, Salehi, have all said the United States is never getting into our military sites. Did we stutter? They're never getting into our military sites. So the fact of the matter is that, as the caller said, if you don't get into military sites, then you cannot verify this agreement. Now, Iran has conducted secret enrichment work and secret weaponization work in those military sites. And the fact of the matter is, as I said at the top of the show, is that the Director General of the IAEA, Mr. Romano, has said in recent weeks that I cannot verify an important section of the agreement called Section T because I cannot verify whether Iran is not engaged in the design and development of nuclear explosives work. That's incredibly important. If we can't get into those military sites, if we can't confirm that Iran is not designing and developing nuclear weapons, then this agreement has no verification. And I would also say that country like North Korea actually was part of the non-proliferation treaty, was subject to the additional protocol, was subject to inspections, and withdrew at the appropriate time from the NPT, kicked out the weapons inspectors, and proceeded through a period of strategic patience to develop multiple nuclear weapons on its way to intercontinental ballistic
Let me
missiles.
Ask about that. Trita Parsi, what about Section T? And the bigger umbrella here, I mean, the title of your book was Losing an Enemy. The suggestion, and the Obama administration would say it, was that over the years of this agreement, their hope was that Iran's politics would change. So at the other end, they wouldn't have an interest in a nuclear weapon. What about Section T? What about the big picture, Trita?
Well, if we talk about access to military sites, exactly as Robin said, there's a mechanism in the deal that ensures that if there is evidence that emerges that the Iranians are doing something fishy, then the parties can ask for access. The IAEA can ask for access to those sites. And the voting structure in that mechanism is such that as long as the United States and Europe request access, the Iranians, the Chinese, and the Russians can never block it. So the Iranians can say whatever they want at this point, but if any evidence emerges or any suspicions, legitimate suspicions emerge that something is going on, the Iranians are going to be in violation of the deal if they don't give access. Now, the problem is there is no such suspicions. There's just speculation. And when Nikki Haley went to the IAEA and pressed them to start asking for access to military sites, she presented no evidence as to why they should do so. And the IAEA rightfully rejected her demands because they recognize that if the IAEA start inspecting military sites, and after the third site actually comes up with nothing, then the IAEA and the entire inspections regime will start losing credibility. And if it doesn't have credibility, that actually would be the greatest threat to the deal collapsing and actually enabling the Iranians to move towards a military program. So it's very critical to make sure that the inspections are treated legitimately and not abused in order to be able to force the Iranians out of the deal.
Robin,
Can I just quickly say, time grows short. Yeah, so the title of the book is Losing an Enemy, because it's a process. It doesn't say that it lost an enemy.
Yep.
But it is about the fact that an opportunity was created in which over time, the other issues, the very same issues that others are complaining about, whether it's ballistic missiles, etc., could start being addressed, granted that we continued on the path of diplomacy rather than doing what Trump is doing right now with this reckless behavior of not only just undermining this deal, but doing it across the board with the Paris Agreement, with UNESCO, and many, many other things.
Robin, what's at stake as Congress wades into this, if indeed they do in a muscular way in the coming months?
Well, as we've talked about, there's a lot at stake for the U.S. foreign policy agenda in general. And the stakes in some ways couldn't be higher. It's kind of mind-boggling how we proceed on this at a time that there is such disunity in the United States about our course of action and fundamental disunity with all the other parties to this accord.
I mean, do you see, Iran and the U.S. in some kind of standoff at the end of what maybe was started on Friday?
Absolutely. With enormous cost to the world in general.
Tom, Iran has been at war with us since 1979. They've killed our soldiers. They've killed our civilians. They're wrecking havoc. They're responsible for Assad's genocide that's killed 500,000 people in Syria, men, women, and children.
We've got it. There are ways and there are ways. I appreciate everybody's contribution this hour. Mark Dubowitz, Robin Wright with The New Yorker, Trita Parsi, the book is Losing an Enemy. Thank you to each of you for being here. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.